The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, welcome to The Interview with Hugh Hewitt, a podcast of the smartest people talking about the most important subjects at length with me, Hugh Hewitt. It's brought to you by AndrewandTodd.com. They are mortgage lenders with Sierra Pacific Mortgage, 888-1172, or visit their website, AndrewandTodd.com. They support serious conversations with serious people, and I thank them for their sponsorship. Now, to The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. The interview with Hugh Hewitt today is with Dr. Michael Oren, who we find in Israel. Israel under attack. Indeed, only minutes ago, the Israeli Defense Forces bombed a Hamas team preparing to launch an unmanned armed aerial vehicle from the Gaza Strip. Dr. Oren, good morning. Are you safe?
I'm safe. Israel, you know, for the most part, is safe. It was quite a night, Hugh. I don't know if you received the videos I sent you.
I did. And we will show those, I hope, later in the program. I also watched the video presentation you made to the Jewish Agency yesterday. But for this audience this morning, since American news is transfixed by old stories about former presidents, tell us what is going on, because it sure looks like a war to me.
Yeah, it looks like the first day of a war. We've had several wars very, very similar in the past. It begins with Hamas firing rockets at our cities. We fire back. We bomb. We bomb. The world condemns us for war crimes, for causing casualties among Palestinians who are being used as human shields by Hamas. Hamas knows how to manipulate the media so they can manipulate world opinion. And then the war ends. Israelis are tired of this. They're tired of this round after round. We don't see the government providing us with any answer. And the only answer is not an easy answer. Having said that, it means sending the army into Gaza at great cost, both in human cost as well as economic and diplomatic costs, but ending this this cycle, which just keeps ending in the same way, which is inconclusively in enabling Hamas to retain its rule in Gaza and to prepare for the next round.
Now, before we go to whether or not politics in Israel has in any way contributed to this situation, can you describe for the audience that may only be watching American cable news what is going on? I mean, in Lod last night, there was what I would call a race riot in the United States. The mayor of Lod called it Kristallnacht, which is a little, bracing to see. What happened there?
Well, it's a tremendous, tremendous blow to Israelis, and I would include myself among them, who believe that there's a future of coexistence with us, Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs. And this is one of the many mixed towns in Israel. Lod, I live in a mixed town of Jaffa, which was quiet last night. And all of a sudden, the Arab residents of Lod turned on the Jewish residents. They burnt synagogues. They burnt three synagogues. It happened also in the ancient city of Akko, where they burned one of Israel's greatest restaurants, Buri Buri, whose owner dedicated his life to training young Arabs from poor neighborhoods how to be sous chefs, and has actually been invited to the White House to serve there, to cook for the president. They burnt it. They burnt it to the ground. It's terribly, terribly tragic. Terribly tragic for Israel generally, but in particular, it's tragic for Israeli Arabs. It sets them back years.
You know, Michael, when you say that, I remember the Stadt Temple in Vienna. I went there because of a Daniel Silva novel, and it's been restored since the Nazis destroyed it, because they didn't burn it to the ground because it was in an apartment building. But it's also been the site of a terrorist attack. That is truly a ferocious attack that's deeply rooted in anti-Semitism, to go after someone's houses of worship.
And not just one, but three. And one of the definitions of Zionism, Hugh, is that the Jews could have a country and a place where synagogues wouldn't be burnt. Lod is in the dead center of this country, the heart of the country. And so we are literally left speechless like this. You know, we've had rockets before. We know how to deal with them. We know how to deal with them militarily. We know how to deal with them emotionally. These riots, this destruction, this vandalism, this anti-Semitism has left us all very shaken.
I am curious if you believe, and we're not rushing today, Dr. Oren, and for the benefit of the audience, Dr. Oren is the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, former deputy minister in the last permanent Netanyahu government. He has not been part of the interim government since the onslaught of elections, been out being an observer and a commentator. His website is drmichaeloren.com. I am curious if you believe that the cycle of political instability contributed to this in any way.
I do. I think that Hamas internalized a certain political weakness here, a difficulty at decision-making, and exploited it. And I've been saying this certainly in the Israeli press for 2 years, that our inability to form a government actually has strategic ramifications and carries with it dangers. Because if Hamas is realizing this weakness, so too are our more formidable enemies like Iran.
By the way, speaking of Iran, Hamas is firing anti-tank missiles at civilian cars and individuals. Where do they get anti-tank missiles from?
Oh, they get it all from Iran. The vast majority of rockets that are fired at us are made in Iran. And one of the benefits of the Abraham Accords, our signing a peace treaty with Sudan, is that previously these rockets had been smuggled through Sudan across the desert. And hopefully that route has been closed off. And what they're firing off now are the, you know, the backlog of rockets. But Iran is a major, major backer of Hamas. And Iran is the exclusive owner of Islamic Jihad.
So tell me about anti-tank weapons. The last time I read about anti-tank weapons, it's either in your book about Yom Kippur War or about the other one, Rabinovich's book, where anti-tank weapons were the crucial change agent when the United States, Nixon said, send everything that can fly. It was mostly anti-tank weapons that were needed. How important are they? Do they ship battlefield tactics at all?
No, they don't, because not in terms of our own tanks. Our tanks, we have developed a technology that renders our tanks almost invulnerable to anti-tank rockets, but this wasn't, you know, it wasn't a tank, a civilian vehicle. And these are largely either Iranian or Russian-made anti-tank missiles. You know, it's easy. You pick out a bus and you pull a trigger and the rocket hits. And, you know, it has armor-piercing capabilities, but there's no armor on the bus, so it's just going to go in there and blow up.
So I also read yesterday, I'm reading obsessively about this. Again, there's a news vacuum in the United States here. India's catastrophe and the war in Israel are the two most important stories, and they're not being covered. I read yesterday that Hamas had a special forces commando group in a tunnel that the IDF destroyed. How does Hamas have special forces? What does that even mean? Are they real special forces?
Yeah, yes, they do have special forces, and many of them are trained by Turkey. And so, you know, I don't know how they, you know, stand up to Delta Force or Team SEAL 6 or our own Sayeret Matkal, but they're specially trained, usually by the Turks. The bigger question for Israelis is not why Hamas has commandos, but why Hamas would have another tunnel. Now, where that tunnel was, chances are it was nowhere near the border because we've developed technology that detects underground tunnel digging. But the fact that they even had the tunnel still, where supposedly we had eliminated all these tunnels, hey, what can I say? It was a less than pleasant surprise.
I watched the knock knock video. Israel sent a small missile to hit the top of an apartment building, and then 13 stories, then told everyone to get out. And they really mean it because of the knock knock. And then they leveled it. This has struck the international community as punitive. Not me. I understand who's in that building. Will it be repeated, do you think? And what do you think of the international response?
Well, it's going to be repeated. And frankly, the heck with the international response. What is it designed to do? We have an enemy, Hamas, that hides behind civilians. Why can't we eliminate the chiefs of Hamas? Because they're hiding beneath hospitals, they're hiding beneath schools, they're deeply embedded in the civilian population. So we want to give those civilians a chance to get away from the area that we intend to hit. And by the way, that carries with it a tremendous tactical price, because basically we're warning everybody. Sometimes I think it's even miraculous that we do manage to eliminate some of the Hamas commanders. But we do this for diplomatic reasons, to limit the number of casualties. But above all, we do it for moral reasons, because we'd like to think of the IDF being the most moral army in the world. And if we can avoid civilian casualties, we will take all possible reasonable measures to do so. Reasonable has to be gauged against the damage and death that's being inflicted by those Hamas commanders on our own population.
Now, Dr. Oren, when a Gaza invasion is imminent, the IDF mobilizes. I saw that Defense Minister Gantz called up 5,000. That's not tantamount to what you need to invade Gaza. Have additional orders been given? Is the IDF mobilization anything of the sort that you would expect to precede an actual invasion of Gaza?
No, it's not. Invasion, any type of ground operation, anything between 50 and 70,000 soldiers. And we have them. The IDF is more than twice as large as the British and French armies combined.
I heard you say that yesterday. 20. I couldn't believe it. It's twice as large as the British and French armies combined.
More than twice as large. And by the way, those armies are getting smaller because the army that Britain fields today is smaller than the one that Wellington fielded at Waterloo. Okay, but yes, okay, but that is including our reserves, our active reserves. And so we have very large reserves, so calling up 50, 70,000 is quite doable, and that's what you need to start undertaking any major ground action in Gaza.
And would that be broadcast? Would we know that that was coming? Because that is, to my way of thinking, a precursor for an actual ground invasion.
Yeah, but you'd see much larger call-up, and you see a buildup along the border. One of the indicators you've seen is the deployment of 155-millimeter mobilized guns. You know, these are basically long-range tom-toms, long toms placed atop tank chassis. And that is usually a precursor to some type of ground action. Right now they're being used to keep the border area clear of any possible terrorist activity. So they're keeping up sort of a constant drizzle of 155-millimeter shell. And you don't want to be under one of these shells. These are huge shells. To make sure that the border area is clear.
Put on your historian hat for me for a moment, your Power, Faith, and Fantasy hat. That's your great best-selling book on the Middle East and America. Did then Prime Minister Sharon make a mistake by dismantling the settlements in Gaza?
I think he made a mistake by dismantling all of them. Some of them didn't have to be dismantled, and we could have kept a deployment around Gaza. We didn't have to. Sharon was absolutely adamant in moving back to the last millimeter. And the basic assumption was at that time that the Palestinians would then use this opportunity to create a peaceful mini-state next door, and that would be sort of an embryonic state for what could be a larger Palestinian state in the West Bank as well. None of it planned out. You know about the greenhouses, Hugh?
Yes, they destroyed the greenhouses you left behind that were supposed to be the backbone of a new Gaza infrastructure for agriculture.
Paid for by American Jewish donors, by the way. And, and they destroyed them. And I think that was a good adumbration of everything that was going to come later in the Gaza Strip.
So that's apropos of being, I'm just sort of a well-informed American goy, right? I just try and follow this, but I have no idea about what's going on the northern border. The two sources I have are the Times of Israel and the Jerusalem Post, because I can't read Haaretz because I won't pay for Haaretz and I can't even pronounce it. But what's going on the northern border? Are you afraid of the northern border at this moment? Not afraid, but watching it.
No, we have to be vigilant all the time. And then clearly the Iranians are enjoying this. And, one of the considerations that the Israeli government has to make, whether to mount major ground operations, is the degree to which this will then let Iran off the hook, whether in Syria, where, as you know, the IDF is very active in preventing Iran from establishing Syria as kind of a forward military base against us, detract the world attention from what's going on in Vienna and the attempts to renew the disastrous JCPOA. Iranians have a lot of interests here, and we have to be very, very careful not to play to those interests.
Now, back to Israeli politics, the criticism this morning from Naftali Bennett, for the benefit of American listeners, he is one of the anti-Netanyahu coalition who appeared on the brink of joining a coalition that would displace Netanyahu from the prime minister's role. Bennett criticized Netanyahu today. Is that politics or is that rooted in reality?
I think there's always no one's going to be able to run a war or a situation like this perfectly. It's perfect by definition. But there are a lot of politics. And one of the big conspiracy theories circulating, and I've heard it from very educated people, is that this is all the work of Benjamin Netanyahu. because what do we do? Okay, according to the conspiracy theorists, and I want to be very, very express to say that this is not my theory.
It's not mine either. I'm scornful of this, but go ahead and tell people because they may see it on their social media. I have seen it too.
So here's what it goes like this. It goes something like this. Netanyahu was afraid that Bennett and the other anti-BB parties would get together and form a government that would get to be around 58 seats. And he still needed three more seats. So the three seats would come from the Arab parties. Either ROM, the Islamic Fundamentalist Party, which had broken away from the major Arab list, or parts of the Arab list itself. So it would be supported either, you know, actively within the government or outside the government by Arab votes. So by precipitating a conflict with Hamas, it forced those Arab parties to come out and support Hamas and create a situation where Naftali Bennett and Gideon Saar, both of whom come from the political right, could not possibly enter into a negotiation or into a government with the Arab parties. And the Arab parties themselves, in turn, could not enter into a government with the Israeli right-wing parties. So this has all been the work of Benjamin Netanyahu. But that is indeed a conspiracy theory.
That's a fever dream. Now, tell me about the reality. When this began, and it began on the Temple Mount with riots, and then it spread to rockets, and now it spread to uprisings among Arab Israelis against Jewish Israelis, Rahm was on the brink of supporting a coalition of anti-Netanyahu people. Rahm's leader broke that off. Do you think it remains possible that a Hamas-friendly party can now support a government in Israel without extraordinary blowback to that coalition?
Not for a long time. You'd have to rely on short memory spans. But that this all is too fresh. And keep in mind that we're up against the clock, that the anti-BB parties had 21 days to put together government. And that clock has now been going. And they don't seem any closer today than they were. In fact, they seem significantly further away than they were before the outbreak of this last round of fighting.
Have they had any more defectors? There was one defector from Yamina, Bennett's party, because of the participation of the Islamists in supporting the government. Have there been other defectors?
There's one who's wavering. But yeah, I think now it's almost a moot point now. I just don't think it's going to happen. There's just not enough time. And we don't know how long this is going to play out. You know, our previous conflicts with Hamas or with Hezbollah have often gone on for weeks.
Would Bennett and other members of the conservative group say we're in a war, we will go support Netanyahu and withdraw it and trigger elections when this is over?
I think it would have to be much more of a ground operation and more complex. Something that would resemble 2014, and which was a full-blown war, though the army only went in to the depth of, you know, several kilometers into Gaza. It didn't actually go all the way into Gaza and didn't go into the major cities. It would have to be something like that. But here, again, the absence of a stable government means that when that government makes a decision to send Israeli young people into battle, it has to have legitimacy because some of those soldiers aren't coming home. And the government's going to have to look into the eyes of the bereaved family and say, we did this as the legitimately, democratically elected government of Israel. And nobody can say that right now.
You know, six Israeli citizens, I try and explain to Americans, that is not like six United States citizens, which would be a awful death toll anyway. It's far more significant. It's likely to get larger. Is there any pressure building to everybody, you know, like World War One in Britain or other past crises in Israel, that you just do a coalition government of everybody ollie in free? Because this is a significant peril.
We're not there yet, as we heard from Bennett this morning. We're not there yet. And the fact that Naftali Bennett, you know, felt that he had political leeway to make that kind of criticism of the prime minister shows you that we're not at a full-blown crisis yet. We're in crisis. But it's a long way from what it was, say, in 2006, where we were being hit by about 300 Hezbollah rockets a day, or 2008, 2014. We've had a lot of rounds of these things.
Do they tend to go exponential? Because to me, I watched the first day and I want to see if it increases the second day. This has gone up every day, but not exponentially. If it goes up exponentially, how rapidly does that occur?
Yeah, it's, you know, Hamas is not Hezbollah. Hezbollah may have 150,000 rockets, and it has an unlimited supply of rockets through Iran. Hamas probably has between 10 and 15,000 rockets, and it has almost no way of resupplying. Many of these rockets are now being made in Gaza itself. So they are going to husband. They're going to hold back as much as they can. They're not going to empty their magazines overnight. If they're planning on a drawn out, protracted conflict, they're going to have to, keep it down to something in the order of 100 a day.
Now, can Hamas de-escalate, Dr. Oren? Because once it becomes an intra-Israel conflict, as it did in Lod last night, I wonder about Hamas's ability to control the tempo of the fighting and to back away when the cost is too high for them.
I believe it can, even for breakaway organizations like Islamic Jihad, which are controlled by Iran. I think it can. But the issue is, Hamas has an interest in, I know this sounds so counterintuitive for a Western audience, they have an interest in looking as if they've been smashed.
That
gets them credit on the street. Yes, I'll give you a quick story. The man who is now Israel's national security advisor, Meir Ben Shabbat, was once the southern commander of the Shabak, our FBI. And when I was working, I was in charge of the Gaza situation for the Israeli government. I went down and spent a day with him, and he showed me a photograph of Ismail Haniyeh, one of the leaders of Hamas, standing on top of a pile of rubble, what had been a house. And he's making a victory sign, the V sign with his hands. And Meir Ben Shabbat asked me, is that a victory poster or a defeat poster?
Huh.
And I said, of course it's defeat. He's on top of these debris. There's nothing left of the house. He says, no, that's when you don't get it. He says that for Hamas is an image of victory because there's the leader of Hamas still standing on the rubble. The rubble is a sign of honor. It means that they stood up for the Palestinian cause. And he's undefeated. He's up there giving the victory sign. So, it's a victory poster.
So yesterday, the correspondent who I follow, I can't remember her name right now. She was in a bomb shelter with her two children for the first time with her husband, talking about bomb shelter protocols with young people. How much of the country are in bomb shelters right now?
I don't actually have a statistic. It's in my neighborhood, which is sort of a middle-class neighborhood, even an upper-middle-class neighborhood. We have bomb shelters in our own homes. So, that's where I was last night. But, in other neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, they have either building bomb shelters or they have neighborhood bomb shelters and schools at the end of the streets.
Okay. Two more questions, doctor. One of them is there an incident level that automatically triggers the IDF? I mean, six dead is six dead. If one of those rockets hits a hospital or something, does that automatically go to DEFCON 1?
It does. Though most of our hospitals, have underground operating theaters now, precisely for this reason. There's always that wild card.
All right. Last question. The American response in the Times of Israel today, there's a columnist saying Biden is trying to please everyone and is not pleasing anyone. Meanwhile, the Abraham Accord partners are kind of wavering, in my view. Not the UAE, but Bahrain was critical. What is the situation with the U.S. and your Abraham Accord partners?
I think with the Abraham partners, I think that the Hamas has overplayed its hand. As long as they were focused on Jerusalem, that created a difficult situation for our Muslim allies. But once they started firing at Tel Aviv and Ashkelon and Ashdod, they lost them. They lost them. There's no support for Hamas, zero, among our Abraham Accord partners. With the Biden administration, the moral equivalency, calling on all sides to de-escalate, only encourages, I believe, the Hamas. Saying, look, I'm getting attention from the administration. I'm getting the administration to put pressure on Israel. That's a victory for them. And I think that I wish that, cooler heads would prevail.
Okay. By the way, has CNN called you? Has any American outlet called Dr. Michael Ord?
I was on CNN this morning, and I'll be on again this afternoon.
All right. That is great news. Dr. Michael Oren, we'll check in with you tomorrow. Thank you for your time.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
It's busy over there, as you can obviously tell. Dr. Michael Oren is the guy to go to, former Israeli ambassador to the United States. And there simply is no way to quantify risk in a situation like this. But all I can tell you, given the near complete blackout in the American media of what's going on there, visit timesofisrael.com and jpost.com for updates. That is where an English-speaking observer gets their best news from Israel. Timesofisrael.com, jpost.com. Without subscribing, neither of those require an investment. You can go there and be as informed as any other American or any other non-Hebrew-speaking individual who can't read that. I'll continue to follow it throughout the days and weeks ahead, and hopefully it's days, not weeks, and hopefully there aren't any updates beyond those which suggest the tensions have eased. That concludes today's episode of The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. Make sure you come back and check out all the other podcasts on the Salem Podcast Network. And remember to thank our sponsors, andrewandtodd.com. If you believe in long-form interviews like I do, then do your real estate transactions with Andrew Del Rey and Todd Avakian. I've known both men for a long time. andrewandtodd.com. Go there, answer a couple of questions. They'll tell you what's best to do with your house, or call them at 888-888-1172. You'll be glad you did, and you'll be glad that you listened to the next episode of The Interview.